get full access to RFR only on Patreon. Become a member of the RFR Patreon community to get more Rebel Force Radio. Bonus shows and content are available right now only at patreon.com/Rebel Force Radio.
Where the fun begins.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
This is Rebel Force Radio.
Your source for the Force.
Star Wars news and commentary.
With Jason Swank and Jimmy Mack.
I've seen Star Wars 500 times. Star Wars number one!
This station is now the ultimate power in the universe. I suggest we use it.
Now it's time for Rebel Force Radio.
We would be honored if you would join us.
I'm looking at the reviews here on Amazon of Bob Iger's book, The Ride of a Lifetime, Lessons Learned from 15 Years as CEO of the Walt Disney Company. It just came out earlier this week. Already 3 customer reviews. Average rating, 5 out of 5 stars. What are people saying? I was just looking to see if there's anything here about Star Wars, like... You killed Star Wars!
Yeah, 3 reviews seems rather underwhelming considering the amount of power this gentleman wields in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
You figured he would have, I mean, crap, we put up episodes of Rebel Force Radio that get quicker feedback than Bob Iger's book.
Isn't that crazy? That's crazy to me that it only has 3, customer reviews. You know, they also have the critics. Brené Brown. Oh, Brené Brown. Okay, so she's one of those gurus, those leadership professional development gurus. She says, this is leadership gold. Mm-hmm. You won't forget the stories or the lessons. No, we won't. I won't forget this for a long time. Daniel Coyle with the New York Times says, people have been waiting years for Bob Iger to share his leadership secrets. Now he has, and they are utterly brilliant. A rippingly good, revelatory read.
Well, they make it sound like all he's doing is sharing business approaches and his professional approach. But he pulls the curtain back and really reveals a lot of stuff that went down privately as far as his acquisition of Star Wars and the Disney company taking over Lucasfilm. He goes through the events in a very matter-of-fact way. And I've listened to a lot of Bob's book, actually, courtesy of audible.com/RFR. The Ride of a Lifetime, The Lessons Learned from 15 Years as CEO of the Walt Disney Company. And so we've listened, Jason and myself have listened to the Star Wars chapter. And so we're going to be presenting it to you exactly as how it goes down in the book. And we will be basing our opinions on where they lie in reality as we consume this book. We're not getting our information from some other website and reading quotes online.
Right.
We're actually going through the book itself and seeing how it all plays out. And it's amazing. It's chilling. It's
one more critical review I'll point to. This is by noted publications critic extraordinaire Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg says that Bob has moved the Disney brand far beyond anyone's expectations, mm-hmm. and has done it with grace and audacity.
Mm.
This book shows you how that's happened. Well, that's absolutely true. It certainly has. I didn't see much at all in terms of hype about this book coming out. I remember hearing probably 2 years ago that he was putting his memoirs together. Mm. This was when he was, I think he had just announced that he was extending his time as CEO of Disney, that the board had asked him to stay on for what, another, was it 6 years, 9 years? what his extension was.
Oh, my God. No, it's not. I think they just keep adding on a couple years at a time for Bob, and it keeps happening over and over again. I mean, Bob does it himself. As a matter of fact, to the current extension he's on right now, he was supposed to retire this past summer, 2019. But he's going to be there until 2021 because of the Fox acquisition. And Bob tells all in the book about what is keeping him there and not making a run for the White House. This guy, right. He's got a lot of pokers and a bunch of different fires, let me just tell you. And it's not just comic books and TIE fighters. He's,
right. First he came for your comic books. Yeah. Then he came for your TIE fighters and action figures. Now he's coming for your country.
Yeah.
So look out, America. Bob Iger is he's mad with acquiring things.
Well, it's amazing how he sets up the dominoes and makes them all fall in a certain direction. It is quite amazing to see how the guy has been able to snatch up so many big companies.
Yeah.
Is it a case of being in the right place at the right time? I think a lot of that does happen with Bob Iger. But he also has this colder than ice approach to corporate management, and it's amazing. And like I said, sometimes it's even chilling when he's using these people's lives as pieces on a chessboard. And one of those lives he reveals in the book is George Lucas himself, the notorious GL. So we'll be digging deep into his book and discovering how he was able to get exactly what he wanted from George, even despite George's better intentions, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's before we get into all of that, let's take a little dip into the mailbag. Let's see what's going on here on the voicemail line. Let's go to how about Drew from San Diego? Oh, Drew, you know what, Drew? You're a little long. We're not going to go with Drew from San Diego. Keep him under, what do you say, 2 minutes at the most. Minute and a half would be great. So we'll listen to that offline. Let's go with, these are long. Look at these. Look at all these. All right, Chris from California. Take it away, Chris. Let's go.
Punch it.
Hey, fellas. Chris here from California, calling specifically about the sequel trilogy, episodes 7, 8, and 9, seems to, and it's pretty obvious, have a lot of callbacks to episodes 4, 5, and 6. You know, we have another Death Star in episode 7, and we have a Dagobah cave type of experience with Rey on the island. And one thing that keeps coming back to me is thinking about, okay, what did Luke learn in Empire Strikes Back that impacted him in Return of the Jedi? And subsequently, what did he learn in The Last Jedi that's going to come back to us in Rise of Skywalker? And the thing that I was thinking about Empire Strikes Back is he had the vision, which you guys talked about on the episode this week, that he could change the future. He saw Leia and Han suffering, and will they die? He learned that he saw them dying. He was able to go to them and change the future. He was able to change things, which is exactly what Anakin couldn't do in the prequel trilogy, save Padme, save his mom. So I think that there's something to be said for what did he see in the sequel trilogy that he's trying to change in the future, and that's his vision of Ben. I think it's just a really interesting observation. What are your guys' thoughts on that? Thanks. Have a good one. Keep up the good work, guys.
He means Ben Solo, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I think so. So if the sequel trilogy is echoing the classic trilogy episode by episode, what can we assume will happen or might happen in episode 9 as a result of that, if that's the model that we're following? And specifically, if I understand his question correctly, how did the events of episode 5, Empire Strikes Back, impact his vision of how to help his friends interfere? I think that's what Chris is.
What was the lesson learned?
Right.
For Luke.
Right. And how does that apply to Ben?
Well,
You know, I think Luke took it up a notch in Return of the Jedi when he tried to redeem his father. He went in to try to save his father against all odds, against the pleading of Obi-Wan and Yoda. So what did Luke learn? I think he's just trying to do it again. He sees something in Vader that promotes goodness and believes he can exploit that to bring his father back to the light side of the Force. So I'd say he's motivated the same way he was motivated when he rushed off to Cloud City. He was going to go and save his friends. But this time, now he's going to save his father. But maybe he's just a little older, a little wiser, a little more knowledgeable in the Force, and more ready to assume that responsibility. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that Ben Kenobi and Yoda were saying to Luke as he was rushing off Dagobah. It was, you're not ready. You're just not ready yet.
Yeah.
It was more than just even like, you can't change the future. You can't learn the truth. You're just not ready for any of that. They had a whole plan in place for Luke that they were trying to make happen. But as Luke became stronger in the Force, then he started receiving these visions. And maybe Ben Kenobi, Obi-Wan, let's just say, maybe Obi-Wan and Yoda didn't foresee that Luke was going to become such a powerful visionary to where he would actually be able to see the future the way he does. Maybe that took Obi-Wan and Yoda by surprise. And then he was someone who was reactionary, and he had an X-Wing, and so figured he'd run off and join his friends.
Yeah, I mean, the question for me, it's a tough one, because it just points out some of the disconnect that I feel about the Luke in The Last Jedi, is that the last time we see Luke, he's willing to give the benefit of the doubt to this, you know, larger than life epitome of evil throughout the galaxy. He's willing to lay down his own life,
mm-hmm,
at the slim chance, because he felt good in him, the slim chance that there's good in him and he can be redeemed. We fast forward 30 years from there, and at the first sign of his Jedi sense tingling about his nephew, he's willing to cut him down in his sleep. Now, there's a lot that needs to happen between the Luke that we see willing to lay down his own life for his father, who he doesn't really know, certainly never knew him as, you know, as Anakin Skywalker, to get to the Luke that is, you know, I think rather hastily willing to kill his own nephew.
Well, I see,
the son of his own sister and his best friend.
No, it's the way it's all being presented, though. It seems it's like it's happening hastily because the presentation is unfolding it all that way. But I thought there was more of a period of time where Luke was working with Ben. I don't think we've heard the whole story, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, mm-hmm, use all your Rashomon effects all you want and pretend you're Kurosawa, but there's still a story that needs to be told, because these characters have been around for so long. And the last time we saw them was 30 years ago. So we're leaving that whole period of time off the table. And also, what's happening to them presently isn't really on the table, because I don't think we know the whole story about the relationship between Luke Skywalker and Ben Solo.
But how could we not know the whole story when the film took the time to show it from both angles?
From three different perspectives, actually.
Three different perspectives, actually, right. And yet we still, mm-hmm, first of all, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between Luke's version and Ben Solo's version, just aside from the fact that, you know, Luke looks all strung out with the dark circles under his eyes and looks real evil when he comes into Ben's hut. beyond that, I don't see a whole lot of difference.
Now, Luke was prepared to kill his father, Darth Vader, when they were dueling and the stakes got really high because Vader was insinuating that he was going to go after Leia and Luke wasn't going to allow that to happen.
No, I don't think that that meant that he was willing to kill him. If he was willing to kill him, he would have struck him down.
He tapped into the dark side at that moment, and that's what gave him the strength to overpower Vader and take him down. But somehow, Luke was going to deliver that killing blow.
Right.
But something stopped him. Something stopped him in that moment. And it was
he saw himself turning into his father. That's what he saw.
Right. So he had the presence of mind to let the rage boil down enough to where he could see some clarity and realize delivering a striking blow to Vader in the heat of rage like that would have been committing patricide no matter what. I mean, that's a fact.
Right.
No matter what kind of a bad guy Vader was and what kind of galactic terror he represented, he'd still be killing his own father, patricide. Then, caught in that rage, he could have been easily manipulated by the Emperor at that moment and pushed over the edge, possibly, okay? But he was able to reel it all back in, rein it back in. And so I see a similarity in that moment when he's enraged when he bursts into Ben Solo's hut and he raises his saber to strike him down. But again, he lets that rage simmer down a little bit to where he could give himself a moment of clarity and thought. But it was too late at that point. Now, with Vader...
Well, Ben wakes up and he sees his uncle standing over him.
He's like, yeah. You dick. And then, so then there's no time
That's
for talk.
That's a rough way to wake up.
And with Ben Solo in that fragile position, already being tempted and pulled toward the dark side, to the point where Luke looked into it and determined that Ben Solo was irredeemable. And see, I think that Luke coming close to Ben's dark side connection may have promoted that dark side rage within Luke that was always there, but he stops himself, you know, he goes right to the edge and something reminds me of myself sometimes, geez, where you just get right to the edge. You're like, okay, let's just pull back for a second and think about what we're doing here.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with circumstance and time, you don't always get afforded that ability to like Luke in Ben Solo's hut, to fully redeem yourself from the act because you get caught red-handed and there's no time to talk about it. And that's what destroyed the Jedi for Luke. But Luke removing himself from the world or the galactic stage to go hide out on Octu, where he had intended to burn the books and destroy the Jedi... that's hard for me to understand still. We were asking the question, I think last week on the show, why did Luke travel to Octu if he was just going to cut himself off from the Force? Why would he go to the birthplace of the Force only to cut himself off?
I came here to die.
Well, he that's what he says, but he also, I think, had intended on not only taking himself out, but taking the secrets of the Jedi with him by burning down those books in the tree. And then there again, you get a situation where an enraged Luke rushes toward those books to burn them, and then he simmers down and gives himself a moment of clarity of thought.
And that's when Yoda appears to him.
Because now we're dealing with a Luke who's opened himself back up to the Force.
Yeah.
And the light side then starts calling the shots for him, as it should. Yeah. So I think at the end, the thing that we can take out of this is that with the dark side rising throughout the galaxy, Luke deciding to off himself and destroy the legacy of the Jedi was a tremendous misinterpretation of what actually can bring balance back to the galaxy and the Force and everything. I mean,
I actually watched Last Jedi this weekend for the first time in a long time.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because something that sort of revealed itself to me this time, and I don't think it had in the past, is that you have Snoke is so focused on finding Skywalker. He really thinks that Luke is the answer to the darkness that Snoke himself has been creating and amplifying. And he's so caught up with that that he really doesn't see Rey as a threat at all. He believes that Luke is the threat the whole time. He's focused on finding Skywalker, finding Skywalker. Rey is kind of just an ancillary detail, I think. That was something I hadn't really to Snoke. Yeah. He hadn't really, he's, you know, from the beginning of episode 7 all the way through when Snoke is killed in 8, he's just completely obsessed with Luke, with finding Luke, killing Luke, getting rid of Luke. And once Luke's gone, then the galaxy is his for the taking. But as long as Skywalker, the promise of Skywalker is out there, then he's not assured of victory. I don't think he really understands the threat that Rey poses at all. I think that he thinks that Rey might just be a useful, kind of a useful tool. Mm-hmm. Really, when it comes to manipulating Kylo Ren, that's where I think his utility for Rey is the effect that she has on Kylo. Which, well, that's another thing we don't fully know the scope of, because we don't know the full nature of their relationship.
I think he looks at Rey more as a light side counterpart to his apprentice, Kylo Ren, and Kylo's ascension in the dark side. Because he says in the movie, he says, darkness rises and light to meet it. And he's talking about Kylo and Rey. But there's a lot of stuff that I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around. And I think Snoke is having the same problem. He's like, you know, what's up with Rey? How does she come in to connect with all of this? And I hope a lot of those questions get answered in episode 9. The lessons learned, I think the lesson Luke learned is that he can change the fate of the galaxy if he wants to, and the Force is guiding him. I think Luke always tries to do that, and I think Luke may have misinterpreted what the Force wanted him to actually do when he decided to cut himself off from it. I think that's his biggest mistake, is cutting himself off from the Force. And how could he just remove himself from the things that were happening in the galaxy? How can he just step aside and say, well, the Jedi interfere and then X, Y, and Z happens? But I mean, isn't it worse for the Jedi?
Yeah, he's trying to stop the cycle.
But that's not going to stop the First Order, is it?
No, I think Luke is in terrible denial, and throughout all of episode 8. You know, he's taking the easy way out.
Yeah.
He thinks that by inserting himself, that he's actually going to further the impact and the effect of Snoke and his influence. And he thinks, hey, you know what? I'm just going to take myself out. A lot of people do this, right? They just say, I don't care. I'm just going to take myself out of it and let the world burn, as opposed to trying to create, you know, make some sort of dent, make some sort of impact. I think he's also running away from his destiny. But, you know, when we talk about it, I know we've got to discuss the story as it is, not the story that we would like it to be or that we thought it should be. But there's just an enormous leap between Luke of 6 and Luke of 8. And, you know, there doesn't seem to be, based on what we know, a lot of opportunity for them to create that, you know, that connection and fill in some of those gaps. It's an enormous leap for me to make. And it was further, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to go back and rewatch it. Then there are a lot of parts of it that I really enjoyed. I mean, I think Mark Hamill gives just a great performance, especially considering that he was so personally opposed to the take that Rian Johnson had on the character. But he gives a great performance. There's a lot of humor in it. There is stuff to enjoy in the film. But for me, as far as the way it lines up with what we know of these characters, even what we know of them in episode 7, it's really hard. It doesn't feel like the continuation that we were promised such a direct. I mean, there's never been more of a direct continuation from one Star Wars film to another. I remember in those days as we were waiting for 8, all the details to emerge, and it was like, wow, you know what? This is going to start moments, seconds after 7. And, you know, in some ways it feels like a whole lifetime between. The characters feel very different from 7 to 8, I think. Mm-hmm. Poe Dameron, I think, feels very different for me from 7 to 8. Really.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, thank you very much for the question. Really appreciate the voicemail, Chris from California. But as we promised, we're going to get into the Bob's Bombshells. That's what we'll call it this week. Bob's Bombshells. But before we do that, got a lot of great things happening over on our Patreon. That's where you can support what we do here at Rebel Force Radio. You can go to patreon.com/Rebel Force Radio and become a Patreon supporter of our podcast and content creation efforts. And we've got two recent releases here. One that I was a part of just a few nights ago. And I love the title of this. This is RFR Rush Hour, and this is where Jimmy and I talk on my drive home. I have quite a commute from the day job, and it's that pocket of time that we can find to chat a little bit about Star Wars, etc. And this week, we were talking about the book. In fact, it was the day that we were first made aware of the book, so everything was so fresh to us. And then we start talking about Star Wars Collectibles, Triple Force Friday, and a very personal betrayal by Rebel Force Radio listeners as they just throw gifts at the feet of Jimmy Mack.
That's what's so funny about it.
Despite all of my pleadings. Now, those of you out in the Rebel Force Radio listening audience know how excited I have been for the Vintage Collection playset, Jabba's Palace Adventure, whatever they call it, Jabba's Adventure Palace or something. And this is the set that really is really the centerpiece, you know, Jabba's favorite decoration, Han Solo in the carbonite slab on the wall. And I was just so excited about it. I was like going online and trying to find, you know, there's a website out there, BrickSeek, where you can actually see what Targets and Walmarts have in stock. And I found that there was a Walmart out by Jimmy Mack that had it in stock. And I remember I was getting out of the shower and I'm dripping I'm dripping wet and I'm texting, risking my life. That phone might have electrocuted me or something. I didn't know what was going on. I might have ruined my phone. I may have ruined my phone. I think it was even plugged in. It was charging. I think that killed a girl a few years ago. Anyway, I'm texting, risking my life to see if Jimmy can make the 0.2-mile trek to his local Walmart to get this for me. I'm begging you, Jim.
It's more than 0.2 miles.
It's what it said.
You got me living in the parking lot of Walmart. 0.2 miles.
So I send it. He does the right thing. Says, yeah, I'll go out there. I'll go out. Leave it in 5 minutes. I'll go out. And he finds that they're on lockdown. None of the new Star Wars merch is being sold at all.
Not until
and our buddy
Force.
Cleveland Chris had the same experience with the skiff at our local Target. There it is on the shelf. He takes it to the register and they go, oh, we can't sell this to you.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, what does Jimmy Mack do? He has a little RFR Patreon meetup at the Galloping Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And all he has to do is just open the doors there of the Galloping Ghost. People just start throwing stuff at his feet, throwing all kinds of gifts. And one of them, of course, was the Jabba Palace Adventure playset, vintage collection that somebody scored.
Yes.
And
I am a collector.
If you think this rant is something to be heard, you got to become a Patreon member and you can hear this. This was the most fresh, I think, that you'll ever hear me.
Fresh. You were fresh, all right. It's not as much of a rant as it is a reaction. And it's a reaction that shook the Richter scale, quite honestly, man.
Yeah.
I felt the earthquake a couple states away, and it was very exciting, very exciting. So Swank goes on an expletive-filled rant, and he takes me down, and not only me, but some listeners as well, some Patreon supporters. So, you know, the chains are off for Jason when it comes to Star Wars collecting. But I just, you know, pointed it out to a couple people. I said, you know, Jason is just, his reaction is echoing the frustration so many Star Wars collectors feel these days.
That's right.
With the weird rollouts and embargoes and lack of distribution in several cases of many different products. And I think Jason let it all
explain. Think about this. We as collectors have been waiting for the stores to get new merchandise for months, six months, nine months. Yeah, really, all year. You finally get to the store, you see new stuff, and you're so excited to give them your money. You take it up to the register, and they go, "Nah, I'm sorry.
No.
You got to come back in 3 weeks."
Yeah. Yeah. We might have it then.
Right.
I mean, are you kidding me? These stupid ass embargoes. If it's on the shelves, you should be able to walk up to any register and purchase it. This is a joke. It's a joke. And we're being infantilized by, is what? That a word, infantilized?
I don't think so.
I think
infantilized.
We're being treated like a bunch of little babies. We're not babies. I'm not a baby. I just want Star Wars crap in every corner.
Give me
my
toys.
I'm willing to purchase. This is America. Capitalism. So, oh, God. I got to catch my breath. It did cause a big problem when Jason found out I scored his precious Jabba's playset before he did.
And then the way you play, you're like, I haven't even opened it yet.
I guess there's a little bit of attitude there. You could hear it all on RFR Rush Hour. Here's what people are saying. Bring on the rants, says Patrick Palin.
I agree with you. It's a reaction.
John Riley says, we like RFR because it's not a I love everything safe space. John, you know, talk about hitting the nail on the head. I want everyone to remember that as we start rolling into our Bob Iger book review in a couple of minutes, because that certainly is not going to be an I love everything safe space. Me and Jason are not cheerleaders for Star Wars. We are fans, and we have critical thought and opinions as not only fans who spend our hard-earned money on things like collectibles, like Jabba's Palace playset that they won't sell us until October 4th, even though we drove all the way over there on a Saturday morning. Time, effort, gasoline on a Saturday. I could have been doing a million things more important than going to Walmart, only to be told by the guy. The way he told me about it, he was trying to make me feel bad for even asking.
How dare you ask?
So it's just frustrating. It's just really damn frustrating when, you know, we want to make these regular purchases and support these products and brands, but you just make it unfun and impossible. KS Geekman says, guys, this stuff is what makes RFR a cut above the rest. Every single time, honest breakdowns with passion and love for the wars. Keep it coming. Swank is on point. Swank. That's a very interesting show. RFR Rush Hour number 48.
Yeah.
Become a member of the RFR Rush Hour tier on Patreon. Also this week we released a new edition of RFR Q&A. We're members of the RFR VIP tier. host conversations with myself, and they guide the conversation. I talked to Kurt Leppert this week, and Kurt really spent the first half of the interview or of the show talking to me about some of my bands, my classic rock bands that I'm obsessed with, and we go through my stash of concert ticket stubs from the 80s and 90s, the ticket stubs that survived. So that was a lot of fun for me. We also talked about the Star Wars Special Edition and all kind of cool things. That's RFR Q&A, and that's made available to every member of Rebel Force Radio on Patreon. And it only costs a buck to get in. So you get cool shows like RFR Q&A, RFR Rush Hour, Clone Wars Declassified, Remastered. We're midway through season 3 right now. So you can rewatch with us. You'll get announcements about RFR meetups at the Galloping Ghost. And for our big Rise of Skywalker meetup live podcast that's going to be happening in December. And we'll be making more information about that available soon. But if you're a member of RFR on Patreon, you will get the first information when we release it. So
Yes.
So RFR on Patreon. Awesome times.
Yep. All that is details coming soon, but we're very excited about it. But let's get into it. These are the big headlines this week. Bob Iger going crazy in his court.
He's going crazy.
I have good news for you, my lord.
That's good news.
Come closer, I have good news.
He's not going crazy. I think it's crazy he released the book. It's a tell-all.
That's what I'm thinking. You know, his initial retirement date had him at the summer of 2019, so yeah. I wonder if this book was scheduled to drop after he stepped down.
Right. I wonder how.
I forgot about that book. Hey, can you postpone the book?
No, you signed a
contract. No, we can't.
It's going out. It's whether you like it or not. But I was supposed to retire.
That's one company that Disney doesn't own is Random House. I don't think they own that.
So I think you're 100% right. I think Bob put this book together with the idea that it would cap off his career at the Walt Disney Company. And because let's face it, the book is not closed on his career at Walt Disney. But
yet the title of the book, The Ride of the Lifetime, it kind of infers that, you know, it's in the rearview mirror looking back on all this. Yeah. But he's...
I don't see Bob going
anywhere until this Disney Plus is well up and running. This is his baby.
Yeah, that is. And it was the Fox acquisition that really, I think it was Rupert Murdoch who said, you have to be there to see this transition through. So these big shot executives, you know, they place a lot of faith in Bob Iger. I think he seems like somebody that... people like doing business with. Steve Jobs certainly liked him a lot, at least according to Bob. And, let's face it, it's his book. So I just found it to be absolutely just really interesting. And it comes from such a perspective that I have a hard time wrapping my head around because of the mere power of the position that this guy has. So Bob Iger, he devoted in the entire chapter 11, to the acquisition of Star Wars. And I listened to that that audiobook chapter 3 times now. It's 45 minutes long, and I've listened to it 3 times.
It's great stuff. I mean, it reads like a drama almost, because he takes you step by step, going back to the initial conversation that he and George had about the possibility. I mean, it was what surprised me, Jim, about the beginning, the origins of this acquisition, is that it wasn't George's idea. It was Bob Iger's idea. They had just acquired Marvel, and they were looking across the landscape of entertainment and seeing what else might fit their portfolio nicely. Mm-hmm. And one of them was Star Wars. In fact, he had the initial conversation with Steve Jobs. And Steve said, hey, we'll call George. And of course, Steve Jobs knew George Lucas very well because Pixar had its origins at Lucasfilm.
Mm-hmm. He suggested they go meet up with George at Skywalker Ranch and have lunch with him and pick his brain a little bit and see how he felt about that. But unfortunately, Jobs got sick and passed away, and that date never happened. But it was even before the acquisition of Marvel when Iger reveals in the book, it was after the Pixar acquisition when they started looking at other content franchises that they can snatch up. And especially after the Pixar thing, it was so successful for them and for Disney Animation that they were able to kind of meld the two companies together and have them both benefit each other so well. They were riding high on that. So they went and purchased Marvel for $4 billion and set their sights on Lucasfilm as a company. It was their corporate strategy to snatch up Lucasfilm, but they weren't sure George was going to sell. And Iger saw his opportunity to get his foot in the door when the Star Tours revamp, Star Tours 2, The Adventures Continue, it opened up at Disney on May 20th, 2011. And Iger had made the arrangements for George and Melody Hobson, George's then girlfriend slash fiance, and George to sit down and have breakfast the morning of that launch, that big deal. I remember watching it on a live stream.
It was a big whoop-de-doo.
Logan was there on stage for that one, and a few other Star Wars bigwigs, and George, and of course, Bob Iger. So they went out to breakfast, and that's when Bob started to condition George, really, and get him into the idea that, you know, making a sale to Disney could actually be possible. That's cut one. Oh, by the way, can I say something real quick? I want to mention that this is not Bob Iger actually narrating his own audiobook. It's a guy named Jim Frangione. And
it's not even RFR. Bob Iger.
Yeah, we should have.
They could have got him.
We should have had RFR Bob do it. They could have got him. Yeah, I would have negotiated that deal myself. So this is not Bob Iger. Bob actually does do a segment at the very end of the audiobook where he gives you an appendix of these life lessons he learned while running Disney. So he actually comes on for that. But for the bulk of the book, it's Bob's story is being told from a first person perspective by Jim Frangione. So here's cut one. Bob Iger pitching the sale to Lucas for the very first time.
When George and his fiance, Melody Hobson, arrived, they were surprised to see that no one was there but me. We sat down and had a lovely breakfast, and about halfway through it, I asked George if he'd ever thought about selling. I tried to be clear and direct without offending him. He was 68 years old at the time, and I said, "I don't want to be fatalistic, George, and please stop me if you would rather not have this conversation, but I think it's worth putting this on the table. What happens down the road? You don't have any heirs who are going to run the company for you. They may control it, but they're not going to run it. Shouldn't you determine who protects or carries on your legacy?" He nodded as I talked. "I'm not really ready to sell," he said. "But you're right. And if I decide to, there isn't anyone I want to sell to but you."
So there you go. May 2000. What was that? 2011.
2011.
May 2011. You know, you're right, because you mentioned, and we talked about this off the air, the way that Iger, you know, a very corporate guy, very coldly explains these things. And you just hear him say, "George, you know, not to be fatalistic, but you're 68 years old, right. You have no heirs." And, you know, at this point, George has three adopted children, certainly all off going and doing their own things. But, you know, for Iger to, I guess that was part of the conversation. none of those kids wanted to pick up the mantle and run the company, or George didn't want those to pick up the mantle and run the company, which is interesting because it was, you know, George's whole one of his big moments with his own father was when he decided to create his own path and not take over the family business. Do you think that he even offered that to the kids? Like, what kid doesn't want to say, yeah, I'll take over and run the company and be the head of Star Wars? I guess it's different when, you know, it's your dad and it's in the family. Outside looking in, that seems like something that would be a no-brainer. Why not do that? What's the downside? But Bob cuts to the quick and says, look, you're old. Your kids aren't going to be taking over. Mm-hmm. Have you ever considered selling?
It must have been a conversation the two of them had, maybe during breakfast itself, before Bob jumped into it. Because what I have always known about George Lucas is that when he would sit down with creative individuals that he was going to consider hiring on to work with, or even cast members for films that he was directing, he would sit down and only talk about family stuff with people and not really get into anything about the technical aspects of the job that they're ultimately talking about. You know, it would all be very homey and, you know, talking about family stuff. Right. I've always heard that about George. And
despite his reputation of being kind of aloof and, reclusive and all of that, it's interesting to hear that. And you're right that when he does get together, it's on a very personal level.
Yeah. Well, he's a family man. He's a family man. He raised those kids by himself.
Right.
I mean, really. And so that was probably part of the conversation. And Iger snatched onto that, or just that little nugget of knowledge, knowing that George wasn't really grooming one of his offspring or another family member to take over the company, then I think that indicated to Bob that that would be a good strategy to go in there and really get personal with him about it. Yeah. And of course, you know, George, you know, the clock is ticking. Let's face it here. You don't really keep yourself in very good shape. I mean, no, it was like, he said he was always very respectful of George But while Bob was having his fruit plate, I think George was having like a 4-egg bacon and cheddar omelet for breakfast. I mean, you know, hey, all power to him, you know.
The greasy stuff.
The greasy stuff. There you go. So 7 months later, George calls Iger and says, I'm interested in talking about that thing we were talking about. And so that puts it around December 2011. And at the beginning of 2012, Lucasfilm released Red Tails, and George was going out giving interviews, and he gave an interview to the New York Times where he dropped the fact that he was leaning toward winding down his career and retiring. And then in March 2012, those guys from TMZ encountered George out in a parking lot, and they pulled the camera out, and George went, I'm retired. They're like, come on, Lucas, more Star Wars. And he's like, I'm retired. We have that audio. We should play that in just a second.
But yeah,
I'm trying to walk down the timeline here a little bit. So at this point, you know, George is in active talks with Disney about selling Lucasfilm. And so they opened up the books, and George's CFO worked with Bob Iger's team so they can establish a value for the company.
Yes, the valuation. Now, this is a really fascinating part, because the fact that Lucasfilm was not a publicly traded company, they weren't beholden to a lot of the record-keeping standards, rules, regulations that you would have with such a company. So, you know, it's a privately owned company. So them going through and having to piece together through memos and scraps of paper, it was a very difficult process for them. Very different than what they encountered with, you know, Marvel or.
But let's be fair, it's not like George was running Lucasfilm out of his garage. It was.
Sure sounds like that when you hear Iger talk about it.
Well,
they struggled to create that valuation.
Compared to a publicly traded company like Disney, it's a way different animal. And they had to figure out how much it was really worth.
Yep.
And so they put a price on it. George wanted the Pixar deal. And I think Pixar came at about $7.5 billion.
Right.
And Iger explains, but yeah, they had six films in production in various stages of production at that point in time. The money was there. We saw
and Disney had already partnered with Pixar at that point and distributed Pixar films.
Right.
So they were a proven quantity and a proven partner. Lasseter cut his teeth at Disney.
Yes, but so, you have to keep in mind that Michael Eisner had a very rocky relationship with Steve Jobs and Pixar, and that's what eventually led to Eisner essentially being forced out by the thing that really did it was Walt Disney's nephew Roy came after Michael Eisner.
His brother. That was his brother.
No, that was his nephew. His brother passed away in 71. The original Roy. This is Roy Jr.
This is Roy Jr. Yeah. Oh, pardon me.
Yeah, okay. I went through
you
a lot of...
You know this stuff.
I've been obsessed with Eisner's book. After I went through the Star Wars chapter, I went through the rest of the book from... essentially, Bob Iger being brought on as COO of the Disney company.
Right.
So, I know his story really well. I think that Bob was kind of burnt by that problem he ran into. Actually, he was actually the one who sort of fixed the problem with Roy Disney Jr. And showed him some respect and was able to put out that fire. And then Roy Disney Jr. died in 2009. But Eisner brought in Lasseter, like you said, with Pixar. Mm-hmm. But Pixar became more a part of the Disney machine. They really kind of brought Pixar in. And that, you know, they call it Disney Pixar. And there's a reason for that. Because it's Lasseter did more than just Pixar. He also helped restructure Disney animation.
Exactly.
Forge that ahead. So he was more of a team player, a Disney team player, Lasseter, when they brought him in. With the Marvel guys, the Arad brothers, those guys were in the whole New York scene with Marvel became really hard for Disney to work with. And they eventually blew all that up and got rid of the brothers and moved a lot of the operations under the Disney roof, you know?
Yeah, and that didn't take very long either.
No, that blew up pretty fast.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think Iger is really now, as he's working on acquiring Lucasfilm, he wants Disney to take it over, and he doesn't want George Lucas to be retaining any creative control. He wants a blank slate that he can develop with his filmmakers and everything. And Iger is very straight up about this in the book. He is extremely straight up. And it was a big area of contention when they were negotiating together. George wanted the Pixar deal. Disney came in under $4 billion as a value for Lucasfilm. But they were willing to spend a little more because they really wanted Lucasfilm. So how did they come up with the $4.05 billion price for Lucasfilm? Well, they just took the Marvel deal and gave George just a little bit more money. And so, well, a little
that
bit.
That was an ego stroke. You can tell by the way Iger sort of presents that moment that it was... He wasn't going to get the Pixar deal, but he had damn well better get more than Marvel.
Right, right. So that's the little cherry he gave George. He gave him the Marvel deal plus a little extra. But with that little extra, that changed Iger's approach to Star Wars films. He wanted to release one every other year.
Yeah.
But then now they're paying more money than they had planned on for Lucasfilm. So that's when they amped up their approach and decided to do saga film and then Star Wars story film alternating each year. that's because they had to spend more money on Lucasfilm. But that's not even really where all the drama comes in. The dollars and cents, that's not where the drama comes from. George got paid a buttload of money. He gave half of it away. And
the other thing that I want to point out, I just want to throw this out, is that the timing of this worked because the federal government was about to pass some pretty heavy tax burdens on capital gains.
Mm-hmm.
And so George wanted to expedite the sale that would save him about $500 million.
That's
so
right.
Half a billion dollars he otherwise would have gone to taxes. So for all of you that are talking about, you know, the rich don't pay enough and all the
all you Robin Hoods out there.
Well, I mean, just saying, you know, all these billionaires that talk about, oh, you know, I wish I could pay more in taxes. I really want to. The government needs to tax me more. Well, George Lucas had an opportunity to pay $500 million more dollars to the U.S. Treasury. He's like, no, hurry up the deal so I don't have to pay the taxes.
And at that point, there was some rocky negotiations going on, not over dollars and cents, but over George Lucas's creative control of Star Wars. George was trying to rig the deal so that he would be able to sell Lucasfilm but continue to work on Star Wars projects as the buck stops here kind of guy.
Yeah. I think he wanted to be the John Lasseter of Lucasfilm.
Yes. Yeah, but he made it clear he didn't want to be an
employee. Director.
He made it clear he did not want to be an employee.
Right. Right.
So he wanted to maintain a really lofty high position in the corporate world and in, you know, the Hollywood world too, you know, which is something that I don't know, you know, George, it's the perfect storm really, because George had spent his whole career cutting himself away from Hollywood. And so now he wanted his baby, Star Wars, to be taking care of the biggest Hollywood entity there is, and he still wanted to play in the sandbox
without being told he has to
go in to go eat dinner, you know?
This is the having his cake and eat it too moment for George. He wanted the $4.01 billion or whatever it was.
Right.
And he wanted creative control over the product. Bob had to set him straight on that.
And he does, and he talks about it in the book.
There was only one person with creative control, George. He wanted to retain that control without becoming an employee. It would have been a dereliction of my responsibilities to spend more than $4 billion and then say, essentially, this is still yours. Go ahead and make whatever movies you want to make on whatever timeline you can make them. Few people in the film business commanded as much respect as George. Star Wars had only ever been his. No matter how much he understood intellectually that he was selling the company, and it didn't make sense that he would retain creative control, his entire self was wrapped up in the fact that he was responsible for what was perhaps the greatest mythology of our time. That's a hard thing to let go, and I was deeply sensitive to that. The last thing I wanted to do was insult him. I also knew we couldn't spend this money and do what George wanted, and that saying that to him would put the whole deal at risk. That is exactly what happened. We agreed to a price quickly, but then we negotiated back and forth for several months over what his role would be. It was difficult for him to cede control of the ongoing Star Wars saga, and it made no sense for us not to have it. We went over and over the same ground, George saying he couldn't just hand over his legacy, me saying we couldn't buy it and not control it, and twice walked away from the table and called the deal off. We walked the first time, and George walked the second.
So there you go.
Now, that answers number one, that rumor that was going on out there that said George Lucas retained the rights to some of his characters and situations. That's why you don't see classic aliens in Star Wars films because George owns Greedo. You know, things like that. And Disney would have to pony up the bill every time they used it. That's why they didn't use the original trilogy or the prequel trilogy in Galaxy's Edge, is because they'd have to pony up all this cash to George. Well, that's not it. You have to understand, and it's made crystal clear when you listen to Bob Iger's book, the Disney Corporation purchased Lucasfilm and got 100% of Lucasfilm. Now, sure, there are people will point at, well, George still owns the archives. Yeah, because George saved all that stuff. A lot of that stuff would have been typically thrown away by a movie studio until guys like George Lucas came along and started saving this stuff. And then over time, you start realizing, auction houses especially started realizing, that there is a value for this stuff among collectors. But
right, just because he owns a model of the Death Star doesn't mean that he retains
right.
the intellectual rights to the concept of the Death Star.
Exactly.
That was all purchased.
And George isn't the only filmmaker who walked away from Star Wars with pieces of props and sets and you name it, and wardrobe, etc. He's not the only one.
Right.
He realized, though, pretty early, though, that that's stuff that he should hold on to. By the time he got to the prequel era, he had that under lock and key. And that was his prerogative. Otherwise, that stuff would have all just been recycled anyway. It was Lucasfilm who created the whole idea of putting film props out in movies, in museums. And
right.
And creating all that. I don't recall that really happening outside of when George started with the Magic of the Myth,
right?
Museum tours.
Now, there was nothing even remotely like that. Mm. And in that quote that we just played from Iger's book, he says, you know, created the the most important mythology of our time. I mean that. That sums it up. And Iger repeatedly says over and over that George was never about characters. It was never about intellectual property, nothing like that. This was his legacy. He goes on to say, you know, George told him that when he dies, the first line of his obituary is, George Lucas, the creator of Star Wars, mm-hmm. has died. That he knows that that is inextricably linked to him. That is his legacy. And so you can understand how difficult this would be for George to part ways with it. And, you know, the way Iger describes it, intellectually, George understood it. The businessman side of George understood that Iger was making the right call and was advocating for the right thing for Disney, but he just couldn't bear the thought of it. And I don't think George, and according to Bob Iger, I think he agrees, was acting or thinking rationally. You are not rational about your children, your legacy, you know, these things that are so personally tied to you. It's impossible to think rationally about them. And I understand where George is coming from when you say he wanted his cake and he wanted to eat it too. This was his baby.
Yeah,
were his kids.
But George did try to do some maneuvering to get himself into a position where he could slide into exactly what he wanted. And the way he did that was he realized the company would have more value if he started to actively get a film into production. So right. he went after the sequel trilogy. And
so here you got, you got the evaluation coming at a certain level. George says, I want the Pixar treatment. Iger says, well, you can't have the Pixar treatment. They've got six movies in pre-production. They've got John Lasseter. They've got all this talent. They've got this entire think tank of people developing projects all the time. Mm-hmm. They literally wrote a book about the creative process. All Lucasfilm has is you. They didn't say they have the story group. They have none of that came up. They didn't talk about Dave Filoni. They didn't talk about Clone Wars. Nothing. All Lucasfilm has in terms of creative is you. And so George goes, oh, well, hold on a second. Here, I've got these movies in development. 7, 8, 9. Yeah, it's going to be a big hit.
So, and that comes up in the book.
Yes.
Cut 3.
Yeah, just being stubborn here.
At some point in the process, George told me that he had completed outlines for 3 new movies. He agreed to send us 3 copies of the outlines. One for me, one for Alan Braverman, and one for Alan Horn, who had just been hired to run our studio. Alan Horn and I read George's outlines and decided we needed to buy them. Though we made clear in the purchase agreement that we would not be contractually obligated to adhere to the plot lines he'd laid out. It was an upcoming change in capital gains laws that eventually salvaged the negotiations. If we didn't close the deal by the end of 2012, George, who owned Lucasfilm outright, would take a roughly $500 million hit on the sale. If he was going to sell to us, there was some financial urgency to come to an agreement quickly. He knew that I was going to stand firm on the question of creative control, but it wasn't an easy thing for him to accept. And so he reluctantly agreed to be available to consult with us at our request. I promised that we would be open to his ideas. This was not a hard promise to make. Of course, we would be open to George Lucas's ideas. But like the outlines, we would be under no obligation.
Uh-huh. But I have a feeling that that was some legal mumbo-jumbo that was put into the paperwork. But there was a mixed signal being sent to George, because when he sold them his treatments, I think that there was an inference that Disney was going to move forward with those treatments and he would be able to work on those stories as a consultant. And
I think George was trying to replicate the model that he had with episodes, 5 and 6, where he was going to be able to oversee the development of the story, be the wizard behind the director's shoulder or over the director's shoulder, like he was with Kirsch and Marquand. And again, he was going to be in this ultimate position where he didn't have all the risk, but he maintained this creative control. The question that I have about these treatments, and we'll get into this a little bit later because I think we have some quotes from George coming up about these ideas, is honestly, Jim, if we're being real honest with ourselves, how developed do you think these story ideas were? I mean, just months before, a year before, he was saying, it's over. Retired, done. Right.
Yeah.
They're just going to, the fans are just going to hate my stuff. They just make fun of me. They don't like my stuff. They didn't like Phantom Menace, And all of a sudden now he's got 3 treatments for, 3 new films that just happened to appear at the time when Disney is evaluating. Now, granted, George is in it. I can't even begin to touch the creativity of a genius like a George Lucas. So even George's, maybe rushed story treatments and concepts about Star Wars is going to be better than most. But,
I think
were these things?
Well, keep in mind, George was talking about doing 12 episodes of Star Wars back in the 70s. So he may have had some outlines that were in various stages of development going all the way back to the 70s that he's had stashed away and ideas that he's been just mulling over but never really wanted to dive back into the whole process of guiding a company through 3 films again. So he shelved it. He would always think about
stuff. Hold on a second, Jim. I've got some breaking news.
What's this?
I've got some breaking news. This is courtesy of The Hollywood Reporter. Headline, Star Wars shocker. Marvel's Kevin Feige developing new movie for Disney.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to this. Lucasfilm's Kathleen Kennedy, quote, is pursuing a new era in Star Wars storytelling, and knowing what a diehard fan Kevin is,
yeah,
it made sense for these two extraordinary producers to work on a Star Wars film together. Walt Disney Studios co-chairman Alan Horn tells The Hollywood Reporter. To the surprise of no one, Kevin Feige is a huge Star Wars fan. It might surprise many, however, that the Marvel Studio chief is going to be developing a Star Wars movie as Lucasfilm President Kathleen Kennedy makes new plans for a wave of projects set in the universe. Mm-hmm. Here we've got confirmation of some of the rumors that we had been hearing that Kevin Feige will begin to take control of Star Wars from Lucasfilm under the Disney banner.
Yeah, we told you guys about this last week. We told you guys about this last week, didn't we? Look at that. Hit the nail on the head. How did we do it? And also, members of the RFR Rush Hour tier on Patreon heard about this 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, we've been tickling this itch a little bit, and now we can fully scratch it.
Now, here we go. So this is where the rubber hits the road. Some see this move as a prelude to a larger role for Feige within Lucasfilm, while others say it merely reflects the Marvel executive's passion for the franchise. Mm-hmm. Top Disney source says Kennedy remains in charge with no plans for changes. But one knowledgeable source says Feige has told a major actor that there's a specific role he would like that person to play if and when he makes the movie. So and then they go on to talk about under Feige's leadership, Marvel has had this huge run, four of the top 10 movies ever released. Avengers Endgame, $2.9 billion, surpassing Avatar to become the top grosser of all time. And this goes all the way back to his work with the X-Men films. Kathleen Kennedy has been president of Lucasfilm since 2012, one of the few women in top executive jobs at Disney, but was picked for the job by Lucas before he sold the company. Blah, 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 blah. So let's see if there's any more. Disney has been criticized. Okay.
Well, that's the big news.
Yeah, so this is big news. This is breaking right now. Thank you for sending the link, Max Sparky, as we're recording the show. David Sparks, he's got our back. He sent this to me via text. So here it is. Hollywood Reporter, once again, the headline, Star Wars shocker, Marvel's Kevin Feige developing new movie for Disney, and it's a Star Wars movie, folks, working hand-in-hand with Kathleen Kennedy. Some say hand-in-hand. I say this is a...
The baton being passed is what it is.
Absolutely. That is what it is.
The baton being passed. You all know it. Everyone listening to the show knows it. Feige will be asserting more power, I believe, as the months start to peel off the calendar. We shall see. We shall see. Very interesting. So, again, we were feeding that speculation over the last 2 weeks here on Rebel Force Radio. And now it appears to be all fish, as the Hollywood Reporter is letting the world know that diehard fan Kevin Feige, diehard fan.
Yeah, isn't that interesting how they're pushing him?
Yeah,
so they're making it very clear that, you know, he's a big fan. I can just see, you know, Kathleen Kennedy at a press conference. You know, I've just loved Star Wars, but I don't hold a candle to Kevin's passion, and I just couldn't be more thrilled to hand over Star Wars. I know it's going to be in just great care under Kevin's leadership. I can just hear the spin, the PR spin, as Kevin Feige tries to do with Star Wars what he has so successfully done with Marvel. Wow, wow, wow. And, of course, you know, a nice way to begin the transition with them working on a project together. Really will make it more palatable for all of the Kathleen disciples out there.
All right, now here's the question. Is this film a fresh, brand new blue sky project, or is this going to be taking the research and prep that's been prepared by Weiss and Benioff? Or is this going to incorporate Rian Johnson in the director's seat? I don't know. Well, I have a feeling that the Weiss-Benioff thing is on very shaky ground, especially with them signing that big deal to go off and work for Netflix.
I agree, Jim.
Which is
I think
the biggest competitor to Disney Plus at this time. Netflix is sitting on top of the hill, and that's what Disney Plus is looking to take down.
I totally agree. I think that I think Ryan Johnson is out. I think Benioff and Weiss are out. I think that, you know, according to Hollywood Reporter here, plans for a new wave of projects,
yeah,
plural, set in the universe. I think the post episode 9 era of Star Wars is Kevin Feige's, this is his sandbox now to be playing in. I think that the PR line is going to be that they plotted this course together. The baton's going to be passed to Kevin. Kathleen's going to go, and she's going to be spearheading the development of the Willow series. She's going to be working with Spielberg again on a new Indiana Jones film. She can't give the attention to Star Wars that it needs and deserves, and it's going to be in great hands with Kevin Feige. I think everything that we've heard in the Star Wars cinematic universe is off the table as Kevin Feige now takes the reins.
This could be a reset. Now, we're getting this news directly from the Hollywood Reporter, and in the final paragraph of their report, reads as follows. While Disney and Lucasfilm have scaled back development of Star Wars movies, in part due to the poor performance of Solo, it's still working on future movies. Both Last Jedi helmer Rian Johnson and Game of Thrones showrunners D.B. Weiss and David Benioff are working on feature product, projects set in the Star Wars universe. That's just an add-on there at the end of the article. I don't know if that's just mere speculation by THR. They nowhere in here do they have any sort of quotes from anyone outside of what Alan Horn has said. So they're not attributing-
Their source is an actor, too, which is interesting. One of their sources is an actor that Feige has allegedly promised a role to, should he ever get the gig.
With the close of the Skywalker saga, Kathy is pursuing a new era in Star Wars storytelling, and knowing what a diehard fan Kevin is, it made sense for these two extraordinary producers to work on a Star Wars film together. Yeah, you know, I'm reading this as a reset. I think because of the Benioff-Weiss deal with Netflix, that kind of tainted their relationship with the Disney company. I think all the controversy that swelled up from Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi has made him sort of a toxic source of Star Wars storytelling at this point, and I think that's kind of the general perception. And Kevin Feige is a guy who has a really sharp reputation as someone who can understand and execute content to a degree that pleases the fans and the box office. So let's see what kind of magic he can work on Star Wars as well. I mean, for crying out loud, the guy has had so many different projects under the Marvel umbrella at work at one time. Adding Star Wars is just like adding another Marvel film to his routine, yeah. I think. But that remains to be seen. Will he start to then extend his influence on the future of Star Wars moving forward? Or is this just a one-and-done film
deal?
No,
I don't think it is. No. I don't think it is. Kevin is he's one of the golden children of the Disney establishment. They would not be pointing him towards the direction of Star Wars if it was just a one and done. I think this is huge news.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people might be asking, well, what about Favreau and Filoni? What kind of role are they going to play? I think they're going to be playing a major role in Star Wars television. I think this episodic television. But one thing, Jim, and I don't know if you pulled this quote from the Iger book, but to me, it was not a small thing when he made the decision to so aggressively pursue a direct-to-consumer platform for Disney content. He talked about how important it was for him to meet with guys like Alan Horn and the folks at ABC and, you know, the folks that are doing, you know, the Disney Channel and all of the more traditional forms of media distribution to say, it's a new day. You're no longer just thinking about producing for network TV. You're thinking about producing for this platform. And yes, we will be feeding network television. We will be feeding theatrical presentations where people buy movies or buy tickets for movies and go see them, so long as it's profitable. But the Disney Plus move is Bob's way of leapfrogging over all of the intermediaries and making sure that they have the ability and to put product directly to the consumer. And I don't think that it's any more apparent than the fact that, you know, we've got the Lion King live action. We've got the Little Mermaid live action coming up. We've got Beauty and the Beast live action, Aladdin live action. Well, Lady and the Tramp live action. Guess what? It's a major Hollywood production that's going straight to Disney Plus. So the fact that they're willing to take a big project like that and move it to a platform like Disney Plus tells me that they don't see Disney Plus as getting lesser than. This isn't direct to home video that we were used to in the 90s and the early aughts. This is a level playing field, and really whatever is going to be the best home for that content and provide the greatest potential for profit for the company, that's where it's going to live. And so I think that Favreau, Filoni are going to be the guys that are going to be paving the way for Star Wars on the portable screen, and Kevin Feige is going to be looking at the cinematic universe. I wouldn't be surprised if Feige ends up having a position even further up, who's going to be looking at the whole game, much like he did with Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And those he wasn't directly involved with some of the small screen productions, some of the, like, you know, Daredevil and some of the other direct to Netflix series, but he was certainly aware and he was certainly consulted.
Mm-hmm. It says, as Kathleen Kennedy makes plans for a wave of projects set in the universe. Yes. A wave. So, boy, you know, working together with Kevin Feige or staying the course and just adding Feige's film to the rest of the stuff that's already been announced.
Now think about that, though. Think about, look at Kevin Feige's resume and look at Kathleen Kennedy's resume. I'm not taking anything away from Kathleen Kennedy. She's one of the most prolific and consequential producers in the history of film. She was a producer on E.T. She's worked with Steven Spielberg, who's one of the most prolific directors of our time. There's no question what her pedigree is. But when it comes to world building and continuity of worlds, there's no one that holds a candle to Kevin Feige. They're not going to take this guy away from the most profitable franchise currently, which is the Marvel Universe, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They're not going to take his attention away from that onto Star Wars for some one and done.
No, I don't think so. And just like with John Lasseter, when we were talking about him earlier on the show, when they purchased Pixar, they wanted to incorporate Lasseter's experience and knowledge into not only Pixar's continuation under the Disney corporate umbrella, but on the Disney corporate umbrella itself. So you're starting to see more of these pieces on the chessboard being moved around. So now Feige is working on Star Wars and Marvel. Does this open up the door now for Kathleen Kennedy to segue into a different position working on Disney films? You see how that all could start unfolding. Well, and with Bob Iger stepping down in 2021, could this potentially put Kathleen Kennedy in a place where she becomes the CEO of the Disney Corporation?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I don't think the board of directors would bring Kathleen in. I just, from listening to Iger's book and understanding all the hoops he had to jump through with the Disney board of directors when he was first brought on after Eisner, it's going to be a tough job for whoever decides to move into that. It could be Alan Horn. It could be Alan Horn.
I would put my money on Alan Horn before I would Kathleen Kennedy. I just think that I don't think that Kathleen Kennedy's reign over Lucasfilm is, you know, outside of Rogue One and Episode 7, she doesn't have a lot to hang her hat on. Yeah, the movies made a good chunk of money, but they were below projections and they completely fractured fandom. Then they started getting political and started bringing that into the conversation, which turned off a lot of fans. And I don't think they want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. I really don't. I think that Kathleen Kennedy is certainly a fine and very capable producer. I don't think that she's a world builder. I don't think she's a great storyteller. And I certainly don't think that she is CEO material. Bob Iger, you know, keep in mind, he didn't come from obscurity. He was running ABC, and so he was, you know, he was making deals. He knew J.J. Abrams, you know, from the development of Alias and Lost and some of the other properties that they were putting together. So,
yeah, it's hard to say anything about Kathleen's career. Her IMDb is incredible, and she's proven. I mean, she is definitely capable of running a company. She's been the president of Lucasfilm for 6 years. So,
But what has happened? What's the track record of Lucasfilm over the last 6 years? Beyond The Force Awakens, Rogue One sort of got a pass. In terms of, I mean, Rogue One was a surprise. They went into Rogue One with very low expectations. Expectations were not high for that film, but yet it exceeded those, and the fans really embraced it. Why did the fans embrace it? Because it was a nostalgia trip. It just plugged in perfectly as a direct prequel to Episode 4, A New Hope. And it also had a great story. You had guys like John Knoll. It was a passion project for him. These are people that really got Star Wars. It wasn't about churning out the next project.
Rocky behind the scenes production.
That's true.
Lots
that
of shakeups and changes to the film itself. It went through the meat grinder before it actually hit the screens. And then, by all accounts, The Last Jedi was pretty much the smoothest running production out of all the four films that have already been released.
Until it came out.
Well, and then the content itself definitely shook some foundations, and we're still dealing with the fallout from all of that.
I mean, The Last Jedi was just like going out and having a great time and drinking too much and having too much fun. And then you wake up the next morning with this terrible hangover and you regret it.
Well, the deconstruction, we were talking about Luke earlier in the show, the deconstruction of all of this wonderful stuff that had been formulated over all the years I think that's where you're missing the mark. In episode 8 of 9, you know, I mean, I think it's like, let's not reinvent the wheel, but again, that's a whole different conversation.
I
see Kathleen Kennedy continuing her career with the Disney company. You know, you got to keep in mind.
I think she's gonna go back to producing films.
Well, she is also a corporate head at Amblin Entertainment.
Exactly.
Which is so the film studio she and her husband developed.
Right.
So, with Spielberg. So,
Right. No question. Look, no tears for Kathleen Kennedy. She's going to do fine. I think she's going to wrap up her chairmanship of Lucasfilm this year and the early part of next year, and she's going to segue out. I don't see her being anything but perhaps a board member of Disney
Corp.
Well,
you know, Lucasfilm does have other things in development, too, with the Indiana Jones, which, of course, Kathleen Kennedy is going to be very active with because she's worked on the other four films.
But and what kind of a future does that franchise have outside of this next movie? You know, they tried to pass the... over to Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, I'll put it to you this
in the
way.
Last one. You know,
I will believe Indiana Jones 5 when I actually see it. I still don't.
Oh,
even,
really?
They have shifted so many chairs on that production.
George have to sign off before they can start rolling cameras? He has. He definitely has a claim to. Maybe he doesn't anymore.
No. The only thing George still owns is that that lost chalice that he kept in the archives along with Indy's whip. You can see it on display.
He's got some props. He's got some screen use props. That's about it.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Interesting.
It.
Yeah.
He has the head to the staff of Ra.
Yes,
in
it does.
A display cabinet in the main house at Skywalker Ranch.
Right.
That's pretty cool. But, that's about all he owns.
I think you can see
Indiana
that
Jones.
On When the Galaxy Listens, right? Can you see that in the documentary?
I think so. Probably.
Yeah, that might be in there.
It's possible.
Yeah, check that out. Yeah.
But so that's
go to YouTube,
the big news.
Our YouTube channel and make sure that you stream When the Galaxy Listens.
Yes, yes. What are you waiting for if you haven't seen it? It's the story of RFR. It's amazing. But what's really amazing and incredible is the story breaking today. It's true. Kathleen Kennedy is going to be teamed up with Marvel's Kevin Feige to develop a new Star Wars film. That is what we know right now.
And no mention of Benioff and Weiss, no mention of Rian Johnson.
Well,
in
not,
connection
not by
to,
Alan Horn, yes.
Right,
yes.
Right, not by Alan Horn.
No, this is,
this is the Hollywood Reporter saying previous projects announced include, but Alan Horn did not mention Johnson, Benioff, and Weiss.
So for Bob Iger, who has realized that Star Wars is a franchise cinematically that requires lots of nurturing and downtime after Episode 9, now has three films that have been announced. Three films. A series of films from Benioff and Weiss, a trilogy from Rian Johnson, and a film from Kevin Feige. So really, if you want to look at that, I mean, that could be multiple films.
Right.
And so for a company
three,
that's...
Three separate projects, though as we talked about, I think we talked about last week, there is reporting on Benioff, Weiss, and Johnson that certainly point to the fact that it's one project.
It could be. It could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were... As Kathleen Kennedy said at Star Wars Celebration Chicago in an interview that she was meeting with Benioff and Weiss and Rian Johnson and that they were working together.
Yeah.
I'd have to think that that project is blown up, you know, with exactly what we've been talking about. Benioff and Weiss, they're already moved off to Netflix. They're probably not even thinking about lightsabers anymore. Rian Johnson, he's like, I'm going to do a trilogy of films, but first I'm going to do Knives Out. And now, while he's out promoting Knives Out, before it's even been released, he's talking about, there's probably another movie I'm going to have in there before I get the stars. It's okay, we see what's going on here.
Yeah. And look at Benioff and Weiss. I mean, the fact that HBO did not make a play to retain them, that's one thing. So they're off to Netflix. Iger makes no bones about the fact that he's pulling Disney material away from Netflix, away from these competing platforms. Why in the world would he? And don't forget the fact that Benioff and Weiss created their own Rian Johnson-like controversy within their own franchise, Game of Thrones,
right?
By kind of. Given the GOT fans a big middle finger, not unlike what we got with The Last Jedi. So why would you invest all of the time and the energy and the resources and money into a series helmed by those three guys? the guys most responsible for some of the biggest fan uproar that we've seen in ages. If I'm Bob Iger, if I'm the guy that I hear in my head when I'm listening to this book, I'm going to cut my losses and just say, you know what, guys, it's been great. But we have Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni and Kevin Feige now.
So that's the breaking news. Star Wars shocker, Marvel's wow. Kevin Feige developing new movie for Disney. And that new movie happens to be a Star Wars film. Holy crap. So is this the baton being passed? Is this a new era of Star Wars? Well, we'll just have to wait for all the big announcements, which will come at some point in the wake of The Rise of Skywalker. They're going to let Episode 9 have its moment in the spotlight before we really start getting any details about future Star Wars films. I predict we won't hear much until San Diego Comic-Con next summer, or even Star Wars Celebration happening in August next year. I think that's where a lot of big announcements are going to be happening. Heck, Lucasfilm is riding high off of their Ewan McGregor Kenobi reveal that happened at D23. So they're like, hey, let's do that again with Star Wars next year. And they'll lay out all the information at Star Wars Celebration. So I think between now and then, we can expect to hear insider leaks and info. But I don't think we'll be getting any big announcements about the future of Star Wars films until next summer, summer 2020, after we've had our large helping of Episode 9 and then dessert via the Clone Wars. We will
throw in Mandalorian in there as well.
Yeah, well, Mandalorian is that's happy hour at the bar. You know, we have even gotten to the dinner table yet, and that's going to happen.
Man, oh man, nine. I got to tell you, folks. Jimmy and I, we've been talking for a couple of days about this particular show, recording this and breaking down all of the Iger news. The last thing we were expecting was this breaking news about Kevin Feige and Kathleen Kennedy, I'm using air quotes here, collaborating on a new Star Wars project.
Well,
Wow.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. This is news, actually, I didn't think was going to break publicly until the springtime. So, wow. Incredible, incredible. Here it is. A week after we were talking about it on RFR Live, 2 weeks after we were talking about it on RFR Rush Hour, the murmurs from behind the scenes we were hearing turn out to be 100% true. Kevin Feige going to a galaxy far, far away.
Amazing. Even Hollywood Reporter calling it Star Wars shocker.
Yeah, it's the Star
Wars. That's in the headline. Wow. Wow. All right. So back to Bob Iger. This sounds like ancient history now, but this is all very informative of, you know, where we are today. We got to look back at how we got here. And so when last we left this tale, we had George Lucas saying, "Hey, here," and he ripped, you know, pulled these rumpled pages, these yellow legal pad pages out of his sock and handed them to Bob Iger and said, "This is going to be good for a couple million."
And
the story treatments.
I think there was that happened at a time when there was question as to whether George was going to sell to Disney, and George was planting this as something that he can nurture and keep himself with. Essentially, job security when it comes to Star Wars. Look what I have.
Right.
I have these treatments. We were talking about like whether or not these were half-baked things he just whipped up over a weekend. I really think that with George's attention to detail about Star Wars and the way the guy nurtures ideas and builds worlds, these are concepts that he has had banging around in his head for decades.
I agree. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Yes.
So he lays these on Iger, and Iger feigns excitement about it and realizes that if he purchases these things, it will really sweeten the deal for George. But they never had any intention on actually executing these ideas in this script. It just didn't happen.
No, I mean, but Iger in the book really doesn't reveal any feelings that he has about what those treatments were.
Yep.
Whether he felt they were good, not good. He just said that he and Alan Horn felt compelled to buy them. And he doesn't really expound on that, but we can certainly infer, as you did, Jim, correctly, I think, that it was about a little bit of ego stroking and making George feel really good about it.
What's interesting about this is a lot of my information about the sale of Disney to, or I mean, I'm sorry, the sale of Star Wars and Lucasfilm to Disney, a lot of my information from behind the scenes came from a 2013 article in Bloomberg, which
I remember that.
You know, and I always refer to this article. It's How Disney Bought Lucasfilm and Its Plans for Star Wars, the inside story of how Disney bought Lucasfilm. And in that article, Bob...
Aren't you quoted in that?
Oh, I think you are, I think.
Maybe I am. Rebel Force Radio is brought up in that
it's a long article. Oh, my God. That's hilarious. That... let me see here.
I haven't thought about that in a long time. I remember getting a copy of it.
Well, this article came out in early 2013, and it really pulled back the curtain on a lot of how the deal went down with George and Lucasfilm.
And I believe they were reaching out to see what the fandom was saying about it. And of course, they looked to Rebel Force Radio.
Yeah, I'm. It's such a long article. I'm trying. Yeah. I'm pretty sure there's a Jason Swank quote in here among the Alan Horn comments and the Bob Iger comments. So the reason I keep this close to my fingertips is because, especially recently, I used it as reference for when I was researching this rumor that George Lucas still retained some rights to Star Wars characters, and we shot that rumor down, I think, pretty well. Oh, here it is. Here it is.
Is this it?
Oh, this is the.
I think it's a real weak quote, if I remember.
It's like Disney sent excitable Star Wars fans into a frenzy by unveiling a plan to release the long promised final trilogy starting in 2015. Their enthusiasm reached a crescendo, mm-hmm. in January when J.J. Abrams, director of the acclaimed 2009 rebooting of Star Trek, signed on to oversee the first film. Quote, it's like a dream come true.
Oh!
gushes, Jason Swank, co-host of Rebel Force Radio, yeah. A weekly podcast. Gushes.
So is that like all they quoted me? They didn't even, true. What, a dream? They just pulled the dream come true?
Yeah.
That's all they got.
I think there's another Swank comment in here somewhere. I think they brought you back for something. It's hard to...
At the time. And you know what? I still, when I was watching Episode 8 over the weekend, as I said, I kept thinking to myself, God, I'd rather be watching Episode 7. I still love Episode 7, The Force Awakens. I still love the way it makes me feel. I still love the memory of Jimmy Mack running through and high-fiving that room full of Star Wars fans there at Star Wars Celebration when we saw that full trailer and the Chewie, we're home moment.
Chewie. I'm dead, Chewie. I'm dead.
I'll always love that film. And it is a really fun, good movie, and I think a very worthy addition to the Star Wars cinematic canon. I'll always believe that. But
so in this article, it is talked about when that moment when George laid those treatments on the Disney corporate guys.
Which we now know as Alan Horn. Bob Iger, was there, and he said three copies.
Well, yeah.
And Horn, said, Iger, and George, I
no,
guess.
No, Braverman. Iger, Horn, and John Braverman, who is some corporate exec. But so here's where I run into an issue is because the 2013 article from Bloomberg has quotes from Bob Iger saying that once Lucas got assurances from Disney in writing about the broad outlines of the deal, George agreed to turn over the treatments, but insisted they could only be read by Iger, Horn, and Kevin Mayer, Disney's executive vice president for corporate strategy.
That's the and it gets a little confusing when you're listening to the book. You have Iger talking about Kevin throughout, and he's not talking about Feige. He's talking about Kevin Mayer, the CFO. Is he the CFO?
He was the executive vice president for corporate strategy.
Ah, okay. All right. So, all right. Not CFO.
Corporate strategy. But in Iger's book, you know, 6 years later, he says that the treatments could only be read by Iger, Horn, and John Braverman, mm-hmm. who is, you know, some Disney mucky muck. I've learned so much about Disney and all of this behind the scenes stuff that I never really knew before. A lot of the stuff in Iger's book is probably not that revelatory to people who really closely follow Disney behind the scenes.
Right. The Disney fanatics. Right. Right. Yeah.
Not like the way I've always followed Lucasfilm behind the scenes, which I know pretty well. I have a pretty good perspective of their entire history and all the players involved. So I just wonder why there's now this discrepancy as to who got these story treatments. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. it's still only three people, but instead of it being Iger, Horn, and Mayer, it's now Iger, Horn, and Braverman. So, uh-huh. I mean, those little things, you know, would I could shake up a courtroom if I'm Perry Mason, you know, I could point out these discrepancies in the story.
Mr. Iger, in your autobiography,
yeah, yeah.
mention for sure.
And as Star Wars fans who study this behind the scenes stuff, that's a lot of times what we have to do is piece together the evidence.
Yes.
So, and yes. that's what we're doing here, and we're getting Bob Iger's story. You know, and I'm sure this is going to be the first of many stories about this. So the story treatments. Iger bought them. I am 100% convinced Iger bought them as part of the negotiation process to soften George and make sure that sale went through. Mm-hmm. And because Bob had targeted Lucasfilm years ago and had long been conditioning George to sell to him. And right. at this point in the negotiations, Bob mentions his book. Disney walked away from the table at one point. George walked away from the table at another point.
Right.
And this is when all of a sudden those story treatments emerged.
Yes.
Iger and Horn together conspired and said, listen, we have to say we both really like these scripts and that we're buying them because we're interested in their potential. You got to back me up on this, Alan Horn. And so Horn's like, oh, yes, okay, let's do that. We have to do that because that's how we'll get George to sign, Bob Iger. And so they're like, all right, well, who else should we include in this? Braverman or Mayer? Oh, damn. And then years later, he couldn't remember which one.
Yeah, one of the two.
Was the third who was like outside of their communication.
What'd you call them, mucky mucks?
Yeah,
one of the two corporate mucky mucks.
But this is how corporate America works behind the scenes. And it ain't pretty. It's not pretty because you're seeing now the creator of Star Wars, George Lucas, getting manipulated and conditioned to do exactly what a corporate CEO wants him to do.
Right.
And this is the stuff George Lucas ran away from Hollywood for. This is why he's always been so protective of Star Wars, is because of this sort of studio manipulation that these guys do.
So as Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage and we are merely the players. In is about to walk another major character in this drama, and that's Kathleen Kennedy. Now, I'm going to go a little out of order, Jim, of what you have, because we've got the next audio clip is about the day that Disney bought Lucasfilm. But Kathleen Kennedy came in as a player in Lucasfilm prior to that purchase.
Right.
So this is the thing. So here you got George wanting to have creative control, but not wanting to be an employee. So what does he do? He hires a new president of his company,
mm-hmm.
Kathleen Kennedy, someone he's very familiar with, has a long history with, going back to the first Indiana Jones film. She's going to come in. She's going to be the president of Lucasfilm. He's doing this. He's hiring her knowing that he is prepping this company that he just hired her to run for sale to Disney.
Right. But he doesn't fill her in.
But
on
he
that.
Doesn't fill her
he
in.
He tells
right.
her, I'm working on new Star Wars movies.
Exactly.
And she goes, oh, my God, new Star Wars. This is,
and I want you to be.
This is great, George. This is great. But meanwhile, he's just he's creating these scenarios to protect himself so he could continue to exert creative control in Star Wars, even knowing that Bob Iger isn't budging on that subject.
But here's what he thinks: I can put Kathleen Kennedy in place as the leader at Lucasfilm. Who's my girl that I've hand chosen?
Right.
I have picked. She becomes a Disney employee with the acquisition, and George can, as you say, exert those that creative control. So it wasn't like Kathleen Kennedy was. She certainly, you know, you were talking earlier about what is her future with Disney. I don't think she has a future. Because she has no beginning with Disney. She's not a Disney player. She is somebody that George chose to come in and run the company. And I think, I hate to use this term, I think in some ways be a proxy, be a puppet for
That's
what
fair.
He wanted
That's
to
fair.
Do.
That's fair speculation for sure. And Iger talks about it in the book. And as you're going to hear, that Iger sort of sees through this a little bit, but he also does show quite a bit of respect to Kathleen Kennedy. And I think that she is someone that Bob Iger likes working with. So let's hear it from Iger's book.
A few months before we closed the deal, George hired the producer Kathy Kennedy to run Lucasfilm. Kathy had co-founded Amblin Entertainment along with her husband Frank Marshall and Steven Spielberg, and had produced E.T. and the Jurassic Park franchise and dozens of critical and commercial hits. It was an interesting move on George's part. We were on the verge of buying the company, but he suddenly decided who was going to run it and ultimately produce the upcoming films. It didn't upset us, but it did come as a surprise, just as it surprised Kathy to learn that the company she was agreeing to run was about to be sold. Kathy is a legendary producer, and she has been a great partner, and this was one final way for George to put someone in whom he trusted to be the steward of his legacy.
That's it right there. He's installing someone that he trusts that will be his proxy, his representative, as the company gets folded into Disney Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I say that Kathleen Kennedy is going to be his proxy, his puppet, I don't mean that in a way that Kathleen Kennedy doesn't have a mind of her own. But George is just saying, look, I'm not going to be president and CEO of Lucasfilm and work for Disney, but I can install somebody who will be, who's going to be loyal to me, and then, you know, still have the future, the potential future, to be a rising star within the company. I think it was probably, given the circumstances, a pretty inspired move by George.
Yeah, well, he was trying to move pieces on the plane board while Iger was, and it appears, I think, at the end of the day, they didn't really. You know, not to jump to any harsh conclusions here, but I really feel like Bob Iger pulled the wool over George's eyes. And I'm basing that all on the stuff that I'm hearing from Bob Iger's book itself. Iger did note that George was still uncomfortable with everything as it was going down the day Disney bought Lucasfilm. He was reading some of George's body language, and I have a brief clip here, cut four, where he discusses that in the book.
On October 30th, 2012, George came to my office, and we sat at my desk and signed an agreement for Disney to buy Lucasfilm. He was doing everything he could not to show it, but I could tell in the sound of his voice and the look in his eyes, how emotional it was for him. He was signing away Star Wars, after all.
Signing it away.
Yeah.
But still, I believe, under the impression that he'd be afforded the availability of playing in the sandbox. And with Iger holding on to those story treatments. And
he was announced as executive consultant.
Right. In those famous sit-downs with Kathy Kennedy and from Lucasfilm. She's been there forever. Their director of communication.
Lynn Hale.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hello.
Yeah.
Those round table YouTube videos.
Yeah,
those were
I think that was the first thing Lucasfilm put on YouTube, wasn't it?
Those were weird.
Those were really weird. They still exist. I don't know if they've removed those.
Like, you get the feeling that like somebody's holding a gun under the table. Like Michael Corleone is waiting for Spilazzo to finish taking his bite of spaghetti so he can plug him in the throat.
It does look like a hostage situation.
Yeah.
I don't know who's holding who beyond their will, but somebody is.
So at this moment in time when that is happening, George realizes that he has relinquished control of Star Wars to the Disney company, but he still thinks he set up the pieces on the playing board so he can move to his advantage.
Mm-hmm.
The story treatments and Kathy Kennedy. So he's got these two things, and then they hire J.J. Abrams. And that would be in January, so that would be two and a half months after.
Now, hold on. We forgot about Michael Arndt in this, because the one thing that I thought was different from what I believed to be the chronology as we were living it was that George chose Michael Arndt to flesh out his treatments for Episode 7, but Michael was brought on board by Disney.
Now Iger does sort of infer that that is what happened, but I don't think that that's really how it went down. I believe that Lucas and Kathleen Kennedy brought Michael Arndt into the fold as early as spring 2012.
Okay. And Michael does have his history with Disney Pixar. Having written, I believe, The Incredibles and a number of other...
Toy Story 3 or one of them?
Oh, yeah, that's right. It wasn't The Incredibles. It was Toy Story 3, which was coming off of a huge success.
But I think Michael was handpicked by George to help him bang through these story treatments.
Okay. All right.
And
it's not necessarily what Iger seems to infer.
I think that George turned over those story treatments to Disney in summer 2012. Summer 2012 is when he gave them those outlines. Maybe even later. Maybe even like September, you know. But clearly before, and I think shortly before the agreement was reached and the sale was announced to the public on October 30th. 2012. So I think that those story treatments were only in Disney's possession for a short period of time before the paperwork got signed off and the agreement was reached. I don't think they had them very long. And I don't think that Iger ever intended to use those, because it's very clear to me that he only wanted to take the acquisition of Star Wars if George Lucas had no control. I think that's top priority for Iger. He makes it clear in the book all the way through. So George lays these treatments on him, and they don't use them. And the very first meeting for Episode 1 is going to happen, or for Episode 7 is going to happen at Skywalker Ranch.
This was tough to listen to.
This is tough because this is where Iger reveals his mistake. And his mistake was alienating George Lucas. For as many times that Bob Iger says in his book that he respects George and didn't want to mislead George, I think the basis of reality has nothing but a foundation in misleading George. So he sells Lucasfilm before the year 2012 ends. I think it's, and that's why Bob had to be so careful. He didn't want to alienate George. He had to be so careful about that. He had to be careful he wasn't misrepresenting anything during the negotiations, because that's what he was doing. He was misrepresenting things. He bought George's treatment and had no desire to execute any of those ideas in future
Star Wars. It was never going to be developed. It was never going to be developed.
Now, this is kind of interesting because we've heard rumors, and those rumors indicate to us that George actually is creatively involved in The Mandalorian.
Yes.
And that he has a writing credit that's available for the world to see on IMDb. And, yeah, we know IMDb's crowdsourced as far as the information that gets posted there. But trust me, if that was something that Disney lawyers were uncomfortable with, they would have struck in that down right away. They would have had someone go in there and fix it. Believe me, IMDb responds when Disney rings the phone over there. And
I'm sure
so. I think it's really interesting that George could actually be actively involved in Star Wars again. And maybe that's something that has given Iger the confidence to go public and really expose all this dirty laundry here about George Lucas and the way that even Iger himself admits he may have led George astray a little bit and could have done things to alleviate the shock he received at that first meeting for episode 7.
So let's set the scene here. You've got, as far as George knew, the last thing George knew was that Disney had acquired, purchased his story treatments. And now here he is. He's about to go into a meeting with the director, J.J. Abrams, his hand chosen successor, Kathleen Kennedy, and Bob Iger to hear about.
No. Bob was not at the meeting.
Oh, Bob was not. No,
oh,
it was.
No,
it was,
no, no, no.
No, it was
not
Kathleen.
Be at this meeting.
It was JJ.
He's got something else to do this day. And it
all right,
was Michael
so
Arndt. It was Michael.
It was Michael Arndt. That's right. So Michael Arndt, who we had been told up to this point was George's chosen writer,
right?
So you got Arndt, JJ Abrams, Kathleen Kennedy saying, "Hey, George, here is episode 7.
Right.
Early on, Kathy brought JJ and Michael Arndt up to Northern California to meet with George at his ranch and talk about their ideas for the film. George immediately got upset as they began to describe the plot, and it dawned on him that they weren't using one of the stories he submitted during the negotiations. The truth was, Kathy, JJ, Alan, and I had discussed the direction in which the saga should go, and we all agreed that it wasn't what George had outlined. George knew we weren't contractually bound to anything, but he thought that our buying the story treatments was a tacit promise that we'd follow them, and he was disappointed that his story was being discarded. I'd been so careful since our first conversation not to mislead him in any way, and I didn't think I had now, but I could have handled it better. I should have prepared him for the meeting with JJ and Michael and told him about our conversations, that we felt it was better to go in another direction. I could have talked through this with him and possibly avoided angering him by not surprising him. Now, in the first meeting with him about the future of Star Wars, George felt betrayed, and while this whole process would never have been easy for him, we'd gotten off to an unnecessarily rocky start.
Betrayed.
Well, that's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
unnecessarily rocky start. Here you got the guy that created the entire universe that they're about to jump in and play around with. And Bob didn't feel compelled to give George the heads up that they were about to go in and pitch, well, not pitch, that's not the right word, present a story and a direction that has no connection to what George himself had. This is significant. You know, Iger does admit to two very big mistakes when it comes to Star Wars. This is the first one. The next one will be when he talks about the cadence and the release schedule of the films. But
yes.
The first one is
he doesn't talk about that. He doesn't talk about the release schedule in this book. That's
he mentions it very briefly.
He did an interview with the New York Times that was released on Sunday,
And, in conjunction with the book.
And that's where he made those quotes about the release schedule being...
So he admits to two different errors, this being one. And this is a biggie. As you say, Jim, he goes out of his way throughout this chapter talking about how he's doing everything he can to show respect to George Lucas.
Yes.
But yet he doesn't quite think to give him the heads up that this meeting is about to go in a very different direction than what he's expecting. And
typical corporate executive, because the deal had been done. Right. His work there was finished.
Right.
And George was just, that was just part of the negotiations. And
George's collateral damage now. George's ego is nothing but just detail.
And so he left his underlings to handle it. His underlings, in this case, being JJ and Kathleen Kennedy. I don't want to throw Arndt into that because I really feel like Michael Arndt was a pawn on this whole playing board, and he was just getting shuffled left and right and didn't know what the hell had hit him, you know. But he was
surprised.
I think Arndt was trying to hold on to his gig, and that was on shaky ground to begin with. And he really wanted to write the next Star Wars movie. He really wanted that. Why wouldn't he? And he really worked hard to at first work with George and then work with the Disney corporate structure and their direction of the future of Star Wars.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised that to learn that JJ himself didn't know that George wasn't tipped off.
That could be. That very well could
be. I can't imagine JJ Abrams going in with somebody who meant to him what we know George Lucas and his whole career has meant to him, going in there and blindsiding him. I don't think anybody was now Kathleen Kennedy, I don't know. I think the jury's still out. I just don't see JJ Abrams as the kind of guy that wants to go in and completely blindside George Lucas. There's no upside for JJ on that.
I think he would have even demanded that George knew of this before the meeting, and maybe he was misled. Maybe JJ was led to believe that George was on board and that they are using him as a consultant. But George didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Here's a question. Why would this meeting even need to happen? Why was this even necessary? If this meeting is being set up by Bob Iger or the Disney brass, under what pretense is it being set up? Are they asking for permission? Clearly not. Is it a courtesy? And if it's a courtesy, then why wasn't the courtesy extended prior so that George would have some foreknowledge of what it was that he was about to hear? I'm very baffled of why this meeting was even necessary.
That's a great question, man. I think it was probably arranged to let George know.
Yep.
Because
he was still
in
this consultant role.
And because they were under the impression that he could consult them and help them through everything. So they were honoring that part of the deal. But Iger does say in the book that that consulting gig was something George was reluctant to do. George was reluctant to do it. What got George on board was Iger purchasing those story treatments from him. That was an inference of trust and that they were going to execute the ideas laid out in those story treatments. And, I mean, why wouldn't they? Look at how Paramount treated Gene Roddenberry. There were a lot of things they wanted to do with the Star Trek franchise, but they respected Roddenberry and didn't make any drastic changes until after he passed away. And then Roddenberry was so respected that they found story treatments for an entirely different sci-fi series called Andromeda that they threw into production based on his outlines for that show after he had passed away. I think that's how you respect a creative individual. Roll the dice on George's ideas. You have J.J. Abrams. You have Industrial Light and Magic. You have Kathleen Kennedy. You could create, you have Lawrence Kasdan.
Yeah.
Use
now, Lawrence
George's
Kasdan
ideas.
Hasn't entered. I don't believe at this
point. Lawrence was on board.
Lawrence was on board at this point.
As far as Lucasfilm goes.
I see.
Because Kathleen Kennedy, I believe, had the idea to do spin-off stories before she knew the sale of Disney was going to go down. I think Kathleen Kennedy started to develop the ideas of things for like Rogue One and Solo and the Boba Fett film. I think those were all part of her plan to make Star Wars something that could be seeing theatrical releases every year. Mm-hmm. I don't think those ideas for the Star Wars story films necessarily came from the Disney end. I think those were more or less baked in Kathy's kitchen at Lucasfilm. So, and that's fine. I mean, she's being aggressive about it. So they brought Kasdan on board to work on the Solo film. They brought him on board, basically said, what do you want to do? We're bringing Star Wars back. What do you want to do? And he's like, oh, I got a lot to say about Han Solo. He's a character that always really interested me. And so they sent him to work on the Solo thing while George was hashing out the story treatments for the sequel trilogy with Michael Arndt. And I think they then ran into, you know, they may have been consulting with Kasdan along the way as well on Episode 7. But when push came to shove and Michael Arndt turned in his rough draft for Episode 7, that's when they fired Michael Arndt.
Yeah.
And
Arndt was struggling with
this.
Yes. And I think it's based on the conditions that and the suppositions that were presented to him about what he needed to do in this film.
Yeah, he was, like I said, he was
his hands were tied.
He's a rock in a hard place. He's got Disney corporate telling him one thing. He's been working on something with George leading up to that. So now he's just kind of thrown into a mess here. JJ obviously starting to exert a lot of his influence. And I think Michael Arndt really got rolled over. But I mean, he tried to make it work. God bless him. And he was able to turn in the rough draft for The Force Awakens. And that's when J.J. looked at it and decided he wanted to take matters in his own hands. And they called up Kasdan and said, Kasdan, you got to help us out here with this stuff. Right. You wrote Star Wars films before. You can help us out. And so he did. And they banged out The Force Awakens. And so they finally got George then to sit down, because George was just like, oh man, this sucks. You know, he's depressed. He's, you know, he's
imagine that scene though. They're at the table. You're JJ Abrams, Kathleen Kennedy, and Michael Arndt, and you're sitting there and you're talking about this. And within probably minutes. Of them opening it, George goes, What are you talking about?
Where's Vader's grandkids?
This is what I wrote. Well, George, we decided we're going a different direction. But I wouldn't be surprised to find out that George just left the room, walked out.
Just got up and walked out. Didn't even say anything to anyone.
Yeah, he's done. Well, speaking of done, we got to wrap things up. We've got so much to talk about. We've gone now. We're long in the tooth here. We're over 2 hours. We are over 2 hours.
Well, we got that breaking news.
We got the breaking news. It's huge. But look, this book isn't going anywhere, and neither is Rebel Force Radio. So this is like we're going to leave you. This is a George Lucas-style serial cliffhanger. So when last we left you, George Lucas just ended his meeting with Kathleen Kennedy, J.J. Abrams, and Michael Arndt as they're going over the ideas for Episode 7. The movie goes into production. The question is, will George Lucas show up at the premiere? Will he badmouth Disney? There might even be a clause in the contract about whether or not he can. This is all coming to you next week here on Rebel Force Radio. This is Jim, you and I have talked many times about we wanted this story to come out. Of course, there's more details and more that we would like to come out. But the story is finally starting to be told. This from Bob Iger's perspective in this book. You have spent the last few days going through and coming through some of George Lucas's interviews and quotes going on record about this. at the end of the day, knowing that we're sort of leaving people off with a little bit of a cliffhanger, how does what we've heard so far line up with what we have heard George go on record to say? Is there a quote or something that we might refer to see how George's version of the story stacks up so far?
Well, you know, I have some Charlie Rose quotes. He talks about being emotional, walking away. He talks about the influence these Bob Iger conversations had because he reflects on how long it would take him to make Star Wars films. And he didn't want to keep making movies until he's 80.
Right.
And the emotional difficulty he has with walking away from it all. But I think the bottom line is, and he almost talks like a kid about it. If you just want to leave us with cut one from the Charlie Rose thing, where George talks a little bit about not cut one. Let's go with cut four, where George really explains exactly what his hangups are with the Force Awakens, and then we'll go behind the scenes more next time on Rebel Force Radio. But this is just George's general hangups with the Force Awakens, and I think it kind of illustrates what sort of Star Wars movie he would have made if he got a chance.
They wanted to do a retro movie. I don't like that. I every movie I worked very hard to make them different. I make them completely different with, you know, different planets, with different spaceships, with different, you know, to make it new.
So
and,
are you at peace with this?
Yeah.
As much as you can be.
Yeah. No, I said, look, I'm fine. Then you get to the thing, which is another thing that I'd been through. Fortunately, I'm old enough to have been through all this stuff before. And that one is, hey, I had to do it. And then you do end up with this thing, which is, you know, you got to live with it, and people are going to talk about it and all that kind of stuff. It's like talking about your divorce or something. It's just awkward, but it's not painful.
It's awkward, but not painful. Wow. Mm. Wow. And you know, Charlie says, you know, are you at peace with it? He's like, yeah. But, you know, it's like a divorce. I mean, he's not at peace
How
with
peaceful
it.
Do you have friends who have gone through a divorce?
Ask
them how peaceful they are.
Even years after.
Yeah, well, because, you know, people keep talking about it.
Right.
It doesn't go away. It's part of who you are and what makes you who you, the individual and the person who's got a legacy. And George's legacy is now owned by the Disney Corporation. And I think that's become a tough pill for him to swallow.
Hit the theme.
I'll tell you right now. Oh, there it is. It's back.
Join us for the next Rebel Force Radio, where we find out about George's turning down the non-disparagement clause and Bob Iger taking him at his word.
Oh, that may wrap things up for this week's episode of Rebel Force Radio, but certainly doesn't wrap anything up in terms of this drama as it unfolds and plays out in Bob Iger's memoirs. If you haven't picked up the book, I highly suggest it. Please go to audible.com/RFR and you could pick your free book. They're not even a sponsor this week, but we're going to give them a plug because you can get The Ride of a Lifetime, Lessons Learned from 15 Years as CEO of the Walt Disney Company by Robert Iger. And make sure you jump to chapter 11, no pun intended, and learn about the acquisition of Lucasfilm. Wow, what a show. I mean, not only breaking down this incredibly revealing details about the acquisition of Lucasfilm, but the breaking news that Kevin Feige and Kathleen Kennedy working together on the next phase of Star Wars. Jim, we both, I think, feel that this is not a tag team. This is really a transition.
It very well could be the first steps in a very different facelift, let's just say, for Star Wars. So We'll see how it all plays out, but I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised to see a future Star Wars with both Kathleen Kennedy and Kevin Feige working for the company, but with Feige taking more of a managerial role when it comes to Star Wars as a brand.
Hmm.
So he could become the Star Wars brand manager. Kevin Feige.
Kevin Feige.
We shall see.
Can he work the magic again? Will lightning strike twice? Going from Marvel and creating that magic. Yeah, you got the same guys, you know, kind of. You got Jon Favreau lurking around. You got Kevin Feige now. Mm-hmm. Disney. It's all the elements are there. As we mentioned earlier in the program, one of the ways you can stay ahead of the curve when it comes to all things Star Wars is to become a supporter of Rebel Force Radio on Patreon. You can get all access to Rebel Force Radio and never miss an episode of our bonus content, such as RFR Rush Hour, RFR Q&A, as Jim mentioned earlier, RFR Rewind. We're going back and re-releasing sort of the polished versions of the Clone Wars roundtables, Clone Wars Declassified.
Trimming the fat
on
those discussions so we get right to the meat.
Right. Plus, early access to RFR events. We've got some announcements coming up very soon about Star Wars Episode 9. You know, for the last several films, since Force Awakens, we've done Rebel Force Radio events, and Episode 9 is going to be no exception to that. Details to come very, very soon. So be checking your calendars for late December. The email address, if you'd like to play with us in between shows, is rebelshow@rebelforceradio.com. That's show@rebelforceradio.com. The voicemail line, 708-320-1RFR, 708-320-1737. Follow us on Facebook, please, Instagram, Twitter. The handle there is RFR Rebel Force. Don't be fooled by imposters. It's RFR Rebel Force. Also, the official website for all things and everything Rebel Force Radio is rebelforceradio.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcatcher of choice, iTunes, Apple Podcasts. It's a great way to do it. Please subscribe. Please leave us a review. Friendly ones are appreciated. But we only have one rule on those reviews, and that is to
make them good.
And you can find Rebel Force Radio streaming online everywhere, like WGNplus.com, YouTube, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud. If they're playing podcasts, we're there. Rebel Force Radio. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time for more as this drama unfolds both on screen and off screen, this crazy world of Star Wars. For Rebel Force Radio, I'm Jason.
I'm Jimmy Mack.
And remember,
the Force will be with you, always.
Feige.